Because this is the last program of this series, I want you listeners to remember a few things about money and hope you always keep them in mind. Money is a public measure intended to obviate the inconvenience and inequity of barter. There can be no society without exchanges, no system of exchanges without equity, and no equity of exchanges without money. The value of money is in the inverse ratio of its quantity. If a country, state, or nation be bonded for all the assessed value of its property, the bondholders, and not the people, are the owners of that country. It is the banks of issue that have created a mountain of debt created through and manufactured by the use of credit money that has brought on business depressions, panics, strikes, and riots. We need solutions to our present system. But before we get into solutions, let's talk a little bit more about the nature of money. Most of the questions I'll pose come from that great book, The Lost Science of Money by Stephen Zerlinga. For example, it is still being argued whether the nature of money is a concrete power embodied in a commodity such as gold or silver, or whether it is an abstract social invention, meaning an institution of the law. Does it obtain its value from the material of which it is made, or from its acceptability in exchanges due to the sponsorship or even legal requirements of the government? Or is it a hybrid economic good, starting as a valuable commodity and evolving in its more perfect forms into a socially valued token? Perhaps the chief failure of economic science has been its continuing inability from Adam Smith all the way down to Milton Friedman to concisely define or discover a concept or theory of money acceptable to serious practitioners as being consistent with both logic and history. Further, most modern economists appear oblivious to this failing, and their works rarely attempt to precisely define money, apparently assuming an understanding of it, or they present highly limited definitions. While these questions are important theoretical concerns, they are also of great practical importance, for the answers will lead directly to conclusions about the proper role of government in monetary matters. It should shed light on whether the power to create and control money should be lodged, as it is at present, by a privately owned issuer, and its evolution, and possibly even its Federal Reserve System and its member banks? Or should it be an abstract social institution embodied in law, which would make it more a creature of governments than of merchants? For if money is primarily a commodity, which is convenient for making trades, which obtains its value out of intrinsic qualities, then it can be more a creature of merchants than of governments. It becomes possible to regard its evolution as some unconscious process not involving human planning or institutional decision. For example, no decision would have been made that wheat or apples were valuable as food. They simply were. And over time, it would have become apparent to all, either through experience or example. On the other hand, if money, in its origin, would have been matters of conscious decision, whether by ancient temple cults, governments, or merchants, it would have been one of the greatest human inventions. There are three methodological approaches in seeking the answers to these crucial questions. There is the theoretical method, using a priori principles held to be accurate, and deductive reasoning has been applied to the questions surrounding money. This would be embodied in what von Mises called praxeology, whereas the proof of a theory is in its reasoning. It is a primary tool of the Austrian school. This is the time-honored method of mathematics and is important in moral reasoning. However, it is not especially useful in discovering historic events. Thus, while it can prove helpful in some aspects of money, it may not help much with the origin question. Then we also have the empirical method. This is based on observation and cataloging of data and on experimentation, if possible, under controlled, repeatable conditions where variables can be observed and their effects noted. Logical reasoning is then applied to the observed data to consistently explain them by theoretical constructs. More often than admitted, the theoretical constructs come first, with researchers later searching out the facts. The great advances in the physical science of the past three centuries are laid to the empirical approach and the scientific method. In the study of monetary systems, this approach must rely on history and, in some cases, upon archaeology and numismatics for the observed facts. There are two reasons for this. First, it is only history which can provide mankind's actual experience with money. Secondly, as the effects of various monetary systems often require several generations to become apparent, a monetary system must be observed over time for its good or bad effects to become known. Of course, the application of the scientific method to historical study is limited. Experiments can be created where variables are controlled. Still, the historical facts contain the data to which theoretical constructs must conform. William Ridgway, Alexander Delmar, George Knapp, and Milton Friedman have been among those utilizing an historical or archaeological approach. There is also the anthropological approach. This approach falls within the empirical method and on the origin of money, and it's exemplified by A.H. Quiggin's work, which was called A Survey of Primitive Money. She summarizes the method this way, quote, "If attention is turned to what is happening at the present day, which was in 1949, among the less advanced peoples, a clear understanding can be obtained of the process of evolution with the possible discovery of the reasons why certain objects became money, while others of equal claims do not." There has existed a certain animosity between practitioners of these two methods, as seen in the following statements. Ludwig von Mises said that George Knapp, as one of the standard-bearers of historicism in political economy, had thought that a substitute for thinking about economic problems could be found in the publication of old documents, whereas Alexander Delmar said that, as a rule, political economists do not take the trouble to study the history of money. It is much easier, he said, to imagine it and to deduce the principles of this imaginary knowledge. George Knapp held that the attempt to deduce the nature of money without the idea of a state to be not only out of date, but even absurd. One reason for the friction is that normally historicists reach an abstract view of money and conclude that government has an important role in monetary matters, and normally those who conclude that concrete or economic aspects put money primarily in the realm of merchants are theoreticians. In our own country, whatever power is over the currency is vested in Congress, and the people in Congress are politicians. Charlie Reese, a former columnist of the Orlando Sentinel newspaper, wrote the following in one of his columns concerning politicians. He said that politicians are the only people in the world who create problems and then campaign against them. "Have you ever wondered," he said, "if both the Democrats and the Republicans are against deficits? Why do we have deficits? Have you ever wondered if all the politicians are against inflation and high taxes? Why do we have inflation and high taxes? You and I don't propose a federal budget. The president does. You and I don't have the constitutional authority to vote on appropriations. The House of Representatives does. You and I don't write the tax code. Congress does. You and I don't set fiscal policy. Congress does. You and I don't control monetary policy. The Federal Reserve Bank does. 100 senators, 435 congressmen, one president, and nine Supreme Court justices equates to 545 human beings out of 300 million, and these are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for the domestic problems that plague this country. He said that he excluded the members of the Federal Reserve Board because that problem was created by Congress in 1913. That was when Congress delegated its constitutional duty to provide a sound currency to a federally chartered but private central bank. He also excluded all the special interest and lobbyists for a sound reason. They have no legal authority. They have no ability to coerce a senator, a congressman, or a president to do one cotton-picking thing. He said that he didn't care if they offer a politician $1 million in cash. The politician has the power to accept or reject it. No matter what the lobbyists promise, it is the legislator's responsibility to determine how he votes. These 545 human beings spend much of their energy convincing you that what they did is not their fault. They cooperate in this common con regardless of party. What separates a politician from a normal human being is an excessive amount of gall. No normal human being would have the gall of a speaker who stood up and criticized the president for creating deficits. The president can only propose a budget. He cannot force Congress to accept it. The Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, gives sole responsibility to the House of Representatives for originating and approving appropriation and taxes. It is the Speaker of the House. He is the leader of the majority party. He and fellow House members, not the president, can approve any budget they want. If the president vetoes it, they can pass it over his head if they agree to. It seems inconceivable to me, he said, that a nation of 300 million people cannot replace 545 people who stand convicted, by present facts, of incompetence and irresponsibility. I can't think of a single domestic problem that is not traceable directly to those 545 people. When you finally grasp the plain truth that 545 people exercise the power of the federal government, then it must follow that what exists is what they want to exist. If the tax code is unfair, it's because they want it unfair. If the budget is in the red, it is because they want it in the red. If the Army and Marines are in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's because they want them in Iraq and Afghanistan. If they do not receive Social Security, but are on an elite retirement plan not available to the people, it's because they want it that way. There are no insoluble problems. Don't let these 545 people shift the blame to bureaucrats whom they hire and whose job they can abolish. And don't blame the lobbyists whose gifts and advice they can reject. To regulators, don't blame them to whom they can give the power to regulate and from whom they can take this power. Above all, do not let them con you into the belief that there exist disembodied mystical forces like, quote, the economy, or, quote, inflation, or, quote, politics, that prevent them from doing what they take an oath to do. These 545 people, and they alone, are responsible, and they alone have the power. Well, that's the end of Charlie Reese's column. I thought it was a good one, don't you? Anyway, many responsible Americans believed that paper money, when properly secured, was a sensible approach to the colony's need for liquidity. When we were fighting for our independence from Great Britain, they believed that the colonies needed paper money to prevent the deflation that resulted when the supply of circulating media does not keep pace with a quickening economy. We gained and maintained our independence from Great Britain by using government-issued money. We would have no United States without government-issued paper money. The gold devotees often refer to Article 1, Section 8, which says that Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. When looking at this area of the Constitution, they refer to the word coin and always look at it as if it were a noun, meaning a metal coin. But to coin, when used as a verb, meant to make or forge anything. That's represented today by the common expression, to coin a phrase. So, pursuant to this, paper money could be coined. People clamoring to return to the gold standard yell that paper money is fiat money. Fiat money is money decreed by government, not convertible into coin. The Coinage Act of April 2, 1792 said that gold and silver coin would be used as money. Well, wasn't gold and silver coin decreed by government? So doesn't that make it fiat money also? Another argument is that gold and silver have intrinsic value, but in order for it to be money, it has to be in coin form and 90% pure. The weight of the coins have varied throughout the years because of government decree. Doesn't that also show that gold and silver coin money is decreed by government and is fiat money? More squabbling from precious metals devotees is that we are now monetizing debt. Of course we are. Wasn't that what the goldsmith did when he granted loans to his customers? He was creating money out of debt. The following is taken from the government study entitled Report to the Congress of the Commission of the Role in the Domestic and International Monetary System. This came from Washington, D.C. Government Printing Office in 1982, Volume 1, page 12. Quote, gold certificates, which are valued at $42.22 per troy ounce of gold, are a liability of the Treasury, are issued to the Federal Reserve by the Treasury against its gold holdings. The certificates represent a Federal Reserve claim on the assets of the Treasury, for which the Treasury has received a counterpart deposit in its account of the Federal Reserve. All gold held by the Treasury has been monetized in this fashion. If we went back to the gold standard, where would we get the gold? The above report states that all the gold we thought we had is in hock to the Federal Reserve. Most of the world's gold is found in India, the old Soviet Union, Australia, and South Africa. If we bought the gold from any of these countries, what would we use as money or trade to purchase the raw material? Corn? Or high-tech that's made in India and China? Gold enthusiasts also argue that gold keeps its purchasing power. Well, in January 1980, the purchasing power of gold was 386.3. The price index was 270.4. This made the purchasing power of gold 115.9 points higher than the price index. But in May 1981, the purchasing power of gold was 197.6. The price index was 311.6. This made the price index 114 points higher than the purchasing power of gold. Checking the purchasing power of gold measured by U.S. wholesale prices from 1896 to 1981, you will find that sometimes gold measured higher on the table and sometimes lower. But for sure, gold did not keep its purchasing power. In fact, historical experience with the precious metals in cases where they were and were not money has demonstrated both periods of abrupt, short-lived changes in value in terms of other commodities and of long-term, drawn-out changes where gold and silver lost as much as 80% of their value and never recovered it. For example, in Greece, after Alexander's conquest, an importation of captured gold prices are reputed to have risen substantially. In Italy, we read of the seven gold crises as about the year 600 AU, when in consequence of the discovery of Torresian gold seams, gold as compared with silver fell at once in Italy by about 33%. Later, with the plunder of precious metals from the Americas, prices in Spain rose about 300%, and prices in Holland and England rose by as much as 500% over about a century and a half. In more recent years, we have observed that the precious metals on modern markets have been very volatile commodities. Gold has been undergoing substantial changes in values in the 18th and 19th century. For instance, from 1789 to 1809, gold fell 46%. From 1809 to 1849, it rose 145%. From 1849 to 1875, it fell 20%. This volatility has increased in the 20th century. According to Milton Friedman, from June 1914 to April 1917, the U.S. money stock rose 46%. 87% of this increase was from gold stock increases, and a 65% rise in wholesale prices resulted. Gold, which was money, thus lost over half its value in a three-year period by this measure. From 1914 to 1917, wholesale prices rose 65% and then increased another 55% in May 1920, so gold coins lost over 75% of their value against wholesale prices in the Fed's first 6 years. Then by June 1921, wholesale prices fell 56% against gold. They dispensed with the gold standard as not real standard because the value of gold had changed violently up and down against commodities. Hard money advocates who believe that gold money has been stable should study these facts. They also believe that the market of gold coin is governed by the free market. But the LA Times Washington Post on December 29, 1986 stated that there are five men who meet in London twice daily and decide the price of gold. They represent Bacada and Goldschmidt, Sharps, Pixley Limited, Samuel Montague Limited, Mays Westpac Limited, and M. Rothschild & Sons. Does that give us the impression that the price of gold is not decided by a free market, but is controlled by a few men? Okay, how about silver? The following is a report by the United States Silver Commission in 1876. They said that the disaster of the Dark Ages was caused by decreasing money and falling prices. Without money, civilization could not have had a beginning, and with a diminishing supply, it must languish and, unless relieved, finally perish. At the beginning of the Christian era, the metallic money of the Roman Empire amounted to $1,800,000,000. By the end of the 15th century, it had shrunk to less than $200,000,000. History records no other such disastrous transition as that from the Roman Empire to the Dark Ages. Trade balances and exports are not paid by gold or silver. This makes gold and silver a dead weight, so far as commerce is concerned. Silver was demonetized in 1873. In 1872, its value was 1.022. In 1874, its value was 0.98909, and by 1909, it was 0.41871. It is not the gold or silver in the dollar that gives it value. It is the dollar in the gold or silver. A full tender American paper dollar was bringing a premium over gold in Europe in 1909. We need to completely reform our monetary system. It's vitally important to be ready with a workable plan. What does monetary reform really mean? It means establishing a fair system that doesn't give special privileges to some and disadvantages to others, that doesn't concentrate wealth and power. It means helping the society create values for living well. The main objective for creating a new monetary system is to take the system away from private control and giving that control to the government. A privately controlled monetary system continues to create unfair income distribution in favor of creditors, and the obligatory payment of interest forces the indebted producers to continue incessant economic growth to the limit of environmental carrying capacity. In short, a debt money system is unsustainable in a macroeconomic system. You can't secure real progress with the private control of society's money system behind your lines. The government money system is based upon the American Monetary Act, which was introduced by Congressman Kucinich of Ohio. The government money system exists where government creates the money as money, not debt, and spends that money into circulation for things like the country really needs. Like infrastructure, for instance. The American Monetary Act fundamentally rearranges the nation's financial architecture in three simultaneous thrusts. First, it incorporates the Federal Reserve into the Treasury Department, a 9-member board appointed by the President to conduct monetary policy is instructed to prevent inflation and deflation, yet maintain enough money to facilitate trade. New money is spent into circulation by the government. Second, the privileged banks now have to create what we use for money and loan it into circulation ceases completely. Fractional reserve banking ends once and for all. Third, new money is spent into circulation by the government on a $2.2 trillion national infrastructure program ending unemployment. The three main effects of reforming a debt money system into a government system is A, it will pay off the government debt in full as it comes due without further borrowing, and B, it will provide the necessary funding for infrastructure creation and repair, which then solves the unemployment problem. Foreign economies are unblemished, and C, it does these things without causing inflation. States, counties, and municipalities could receive grants from the Treasury Department, solving the many-stage budget crisis, keeping our word on pensions, and paying for unfunded federal mandates. Recently, civil engineers have stated that we need to invest $6.2 trillion in our infrastructure. If we borrowed the same amount to invest in the infrastructure, our total cost would probably be at least $11 trillion if interest were factored into the total equation. If this money were created by our Treasury Department and spent into circulation, it would certainly cut down our unemployment problem, if not eliminate it altogether. States, counties, and municipalities could receive grants from the Treasury Department, solving the many state budget crises, keeping our word on pensions, and paying for unfunded federal mandates. Universal preschool and undergraduate education could be provided without indebting our youth. Medical care could provide universal coverage. All of this without adding neither a dime to our debt nor a tick to inflation. We don't need to do away with banks or go to a metallic money. We need to make the creation of money a government function, not a banking function. And we need to do away with usury and the fractional reserve system. Well, this about does it for my part of the show, Money Matters. I think I have pretty much ripped our current monetary system apart. But remember, the system does not need to be ripped apart. It just needs to be changed. If it were only ripped apart, we would have chaos like civilization has never seen. So don't tear it up. Just improve it and make it better for the next generation. Hope you enjoyed this program as much as I did. Sure hope you learned something and can do something about it, which will enrich our circumstances. Now it's my turn not to say so long, but to say goodbye, and I really have enjoyed it.